Previously on Robbery, Inc. A small town local bank, a 135-foot tunnel, and a mysterious amount of missing funds stolen in the dead of night.
I got a phone call from the bank, and they said, come over here immediately. People have broken into the vault.
After they opened up the vault, I think it was on a timer, and when it opened up, they saw all of this stuff that was broken into and seen where somebody had come up through the floor inside the vault.
When Merida police discovered a Mission Impossible-style burglary at the Cobb Exchange Bank in April 1974, it shocked the small Georgia community, reaching national headlines. Within hours, police discovered that three men, under aliases, had rented a space across the street from the bank, digging a tunnel under the busiest road in town for 2 months before breaking into the bank's safe deposit vault with dynamite. But these thieves didn't make off with a sizable bounty, according to police. They only made off with $1,000 in cash. But how true was that really?
They spent a lot of time doing it. But I think they probably reaped their rewards.
In April 1974, a group of thieves tunneled beneath Roswell Street in Merida, Georgia, and blasted their way into the Cobb Exchange Bank vault, only to be mocked for escaping with just $1,000. But as investigators dug deeper, they uncovered a far bigger mystery and the story of a career bank robber whose daring heists and prison escapes made him a legend. This is Robbery, Inc., from Georgia Public Broadcasting and the Merida Daily Journal. Lou Abernathy was exhausted by the time she reported to her shift Monday morning at the Cobb Exchange Bank. The night before, after the 28th Annual Tony Awards aired on ABC,
and your hosts, Peter Falk, Florence Henderson, Robert Preston, Cicely Tyson, bring you the 28th Annual Celebration of the American Theater Wing's Tony Awards.
Lou had fallen asleep in her bed, only to be awoken by the telephone at 3:30 a.m., It was the police, again. The alarm inside the bank had been discharged. As the on-call teller, the officers asked Lou to come down to the Cobb Exchange Bank and let them inside to investigate. It was the second time that weekend the alarm had gone off since the closing shift on Saturday afternoon. After pulling herself from her cozy bed and dressing as quickly as she could, Lou hopped into her car and pulled out on the winding driveway on South Woodland Drive. The houses along Whitlock and West Marietta were quiet, the night air cool. Within minutes, Lou had arrived at 647 Roswell Street. A small sliver of light from the waning moon barely illuminated the bank. The storefronts of the Firestone Tire Shop and Eubanks Produce were dark and vacant. Across the street, a lone handwritten opening soon sign hung in the windows of a small hair salon in the basement of the Cobb County Emergency Aid Building. The Merida police officers were waiting for her and used Lou's keys to enter the bank. Inside, nothing was amiss. Lou and the officers swept through the lobby, eyeing the doors and windows, looking behind and underneath the counters. The tells had been emptied on Saturday during the last shift. All the checks, deposits, and cash from the weekend had been stored in the vault. They had checked everything during their sweep, except the vault, which was equipped with a time lock. Even with the correct combination, which Lou had, there was no way in or out of the vault until 8 a.m. Monday morning. Or so they had thought. My name is Madison Elizabeth Hogan, and you're listening to Robbery, Inc., Episode 2, Mission Impossible. We last left off with Rupert Raines, a retired assistant chief of the Merida Police Department. As a recap, Rupert was at the scene of the burglary of the Cobb Exchange Bank on April 22, 1974. He was the officer quoted in the front page story of the Merida Daily Journal that claimed the thieves had only made off with about $1,000 in deposits and cash. Minus the rent they had paid for the would-be beauty shop, police and journalists believed the thieves had broken even in their disappointing haul. Rupert also shared with us his recollection of safety deposit boxes being tampered with and possibly holding an unknown sum of money, valuables, and other private treasures.
They had knocked the doors off of everybody's box that they had rented. And we have no idea how much money or what was taken out of those boxes because no one knew what was in them except the people that had rented them.
Surprisingly enough, Rupert just so happened to be one of the police officers that responded to the Cobb Exchange Bank during those weekend false alarms.
Well, I worked the evening shift, and I worked from 3 o'clock in the afternoon to 11 o'clock at night. And we got a call that the alarm was going off at the Cobb Exchange Bank. And I might have been a lieutenant at the time. I don't know. But anyway, I was in charge of the evening shift. And when we got the call, you know, several officers responded. And we looked the building over and could not find any entrance or anything that was out of order or out of the ordinary. And so we, you know, they notified the bankers, the people in charge of the bank and this kind of stuff. Well, they come out and they reset the alarm. Well, after they did that, about 15 minutes later, the alarm goes off again. And so we call them back out. And so this time they open up the doors and go inside, and nothing's out of the ordinary. Everything is just like it's supposed to be. And there was no sign of any intrusion or anything else, you know, going. So we all left.
It wouldn't be till 8:10 that morning that Merida police would realize those false alarms were, in fact, right on the money. According to the police records and newspaper archives from the MDJ, the alarm first went off about 11 p.m. Sunday, April 21st, and again about 3:30 a.m. Monday, April 22nd.
So they decided it was a malfunction. And they must have turned the alarm off, and I'm assuming that because it didn't go off anymore, but I know there had to be some more activity in that bank that would have created an alarm going off.
It seems, either by design or sheer luck, the burglars were undetected thanks to the mechanisms in place on the vault. As we've stated, the safety deposit room was sealed behind a vault equipped with a time lock. Now, let's take a minute to actually dive into what a time lock is. Time locks were developed toward the end of the 19th century as a failsafe against would-be robbers and burglars. By restricting the times at which anyone, whether it's the employees of the bank or criminals, can enter the room, it decreases the chance of that safe being breached. It was also created to diminish the chances of an employee being kidnapped or tortured for their combination. If a teller were ever forced to enter their combination under duress, a time lock would be another obstacle thieves would have to overcome. Because the burglary entry point was behind lock and key, Captain Rupert Raines, Lou Abernathy, and the other officers were unaware of the scheme afoot till hours later. But how exactly were these intruders able to tunnel 135 feet under one of the busiest roads at one of the most popular banks in town, undetected for months on end? And pray tell, how did they manage to bust through nearly 20 inches of steel-reinforced concrete?
Several partial sticks of DuPont 60% dynamite, manufactured on September 14, 1972, one 28-inch wrecking bar, one 16-inch pick, one claw hammer.
What you're hearing is a list of real evidence found within the tunnel under Roswell Street, according to the Merida police report taken the first day of the burglary investigation.
18 3/4-inch drill bits. Two medical tape dispensers, one green and white suit bag, one 22-cubic-foot acetylene tank with the name M&A Welding Supply Company listed, with gauges, several feet of hose, and an airco.
While this is only a small portion of the entire evidence found at the scene, which we'll get into shortly, it paints quite a picture, doesn't it?
Oxygen tank, one 2-cell flashlight, 3 pairs of cotton gloves.
You can only imagine what our grifters were up to in the middle of the night, under the earth, digging towards victory. Here's what MDJ columnist Bill Kinney wrote about the feat.
How did the daring burglars who tunneled their way into the Cobb Exchange Bank know when they were nearing the bank building? How did they get air into the tunnel? A close examination of the yard in front of the building disclosed that an iron stake apparently had been driven into the ground behind shrubbery. Then a small water pipe was used to replace the iron stake. When the diggers hit the pipe, they knew they had reached the bank. Once to this point, the diggers then could suck air into their lungs from street level, 5 or 6 feet above. They could also hear what was going on at ground level. The pipes had been carefully concealed by straw. After studying the intricate plans laid by the burglars, police are mystified over why they apparently did not wear gas masks once they broke through into the vault. Despite missing the bank's cash vault, the hoods could have stolen untold amounts of money and valuables from individual safe deposit box in the vault. The culprits hurriedly abandoned all of their other burglary tools, so it stands to reason if they had worn gas masks, they too would have been at the scene. When the suspects finally are put behind bars, the press will be able to disclose some other facts that are known but might hinder quick apprehension of the culprits. So if it reminds you of a chapter from Mission Impossible, hold your patience until the case is cracked. Incidentally, the robbery made national TV. Walter Cronkite used it as the close to his Tuesday nationwide news program, entitling the event as an unprofitable bank robbery in suburban Atlanta. And that's the way it is, as Cronkite says.
As Bill Kinney wrote, by Tuesday, April 23rd, 1974, news of the Marietta burglary hit national headlines, but more as a punchline rather than a gripping tale of crime. The New York Times wrote, "Booty from bank is net loss," with a short mention on page 14. As a journalist, I can tell you that's like a footnote for the history books, folks. In Marietta, and on the national stage, it seemed the burglars were the butt of a joke. Peggy Crow, who was a cashier at the bank during the burglary and the daughter of Arthur Crow, the landlord who rented a space out to the thieves, said it was more humorous than fear-inducing.
So going back to what you were saying earlier, that you and your dad kind of felt like it was a joke with the tunnel, and then we find out that they've only stolen about $2,000. Those were the initial reports. And they had paid your father at least $1,000 in rent. So really, they only made off with about $1,000. So they were kind of the running joke around town, were they not? The
robbers? Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, and actually, Daddy didn't always collect rent, so they could have made their whole money back if they had just been smart and not paid him rent.
What was the attitude of the community after this happened?
Yeah, I think everybody was just surprised. But again, Marietta was such a small town then that it's just kind of the buzz of the town. But just from our end, it was just humorous. So probably most people we talked about, we just laughed with them about it. So I don't know if other people were horrified. We were not.
You know, they realized that those people knew what they were doing and what they was after. And of course, now some of the other banks might have been worried a little bit, but as far as the community itself, no, there was no nervousness, no outcries of any kind.
Make no mistake, as funny as locals thought the burglary was, they were just as equally impressed by the stunt. For days after the incident, police would be quoted in the MDJ as calling the bank robbers professionals, which quickly changed to amateurs as the investigation progressed. Cobb County as a whole had a population of about 250,000 by the mid-70s, with Marietta housing only a few thousand residents at the time. It was big news for those living there.
One thing that I've constantly heard from a lot of OMs, as we've already expunged on, is that everybody banked there at the time.
Yes. Yes.
Would you say that it was targeted a lot in terms of theft or robbery?
I never remember thinking about that. You know, the worst thing that I could think about is I cashed somebody's check and then I found out later that it was bad, but they came back and paid for it. So that's absolutely the worst thing that ever happened to me there. So it to me was just a hometown, friendly place to be, knew your customers. It was just a very casual, just like Marietta was.
As amicable and as quiet as Marietta was, one of its most popular banks would appear to be vulnerable and penetrable to our burglars. Marietta officers, led by Chief Harold Pilant Buckcraft, and FBI agents would quickly discover how intricate their plan had been. Here's more from the original police reports.
Inside the vault, strong odors were detected. One of the odors appeared to be of a freshly used explosive. The hole in the floor of the vault was approximately 17 by 17 inches, and it appeared that the hole was created through the use of drilling, cutting, and explosives. The floor at this point was approximately 20 inches thick of concrete, reinforced with steel rods. It was also noted that the drop ceiling in the vault had been damaged extensively by the blast or combination of blasts. Chief Kraft descended into the opening in the floor of the vault. It was determined that the acetylene torch was still on the acetylene tank that had been left inside the tunnel created by the thieves. The hole appeared to be approximately 6 feet deep at this point and contained several pieces of reinforcing rod and pieces of broken concrete. Photographs were taken by Detective Wallace and Terry Wilson, and Detective Wallace began processing various items inside the vault for latent prints. Several tools were found in the tunnel and also in the basement of the adjoining building across the street. These were punches, hammers, hacksaws, an acetylene torch, several pairs of garden gloves, and pieces of garden hose. In the basement of the building, there were several Cobb Exchange bank bags found that had been cut open. A Marietta Housing Authority bag, Burger King, Century Finance, Serval, Martin Finance Corp. Also in the basement were two green Cobb Exchange bank bags, zip-up type. Pieces of dynamite and caps were found, and wire running from the building across the street to the bank through the tunnel, which was apparently used to set the dynamite off.
Across the street in the basement of the Cobb County Emergency Aid Building, law enforcement discovered rooms full of supplies, evidence, and mostly dirt. Red Georgia clay smeared across the floors, staining the walls and filled more than two rooms, one of which measured 14 by 23 feet, up to a depth of 6 feet. Now, this is where I'm going to walk you through what it actually looks like if you were to walk into the building, which does exist to this day. The basement was much larger than expected for a beauty parlor. After entering, there's a storage room near the entrance. A tunnel entrance was found in the back room. Nearby is an L-shaped room, a small room in one corner, and another small room across from it, where a side tunnel entrance was discovered. Another room sits just beyond the main tunnel entrance. The farthest areas of the basement were mostly empty, connected by a hallway with two restrooms in the middle.
It was noted that the numerous items were scattered throughout the rooms and that work had been progressing on the project for some time. The thieves had knocked out an inside wall of a concrete block on the north side of the building and began digging a tunnel underground for a distance of 135 feet and 9 inches, the tunnel going approximately 6 feet underground. The tunnel opening was approximately 2 feet and 1 inch high and 2 feet by 7 inches wide. The entire tunnel had been shored by using 2x4s, 4x4s, plywood, and 1 inch shelving. It was noted that several shelves had apparently been sawed up that were originally in the supply storage area. It appeared the thieves had purchased quite a bit of lumber for the project. After the thieves had tunneled through the inner and outer walls, they apparently decided to also make an opening in the wall of an adjacent room located in the extreme northwest corner of the basement. This opening was 3 feet and 10 inches in width and 2 feet and 10 inches in height and gave the thieves a side entrance into the tunnel, probably for easier removal of dirt. This room contained numerous stacks of boxes filled with dirt. In the main entrance in the tunnel, They had constructed a ramp for easier access to the tunnel. They had used a water hose to wet down the soil during their digging to make the soil easier to dig. It also appeared that they used some electrical wires already existing in the building to rig up a buzzer system to use in signaling by the person in the tunnel and the person at the entrance of the tunnel.
Throughout the suite, police found over 100 pieces of evidence ranging from professional tools to regular household items. I won't bore you with some of the less sensational parts, but these are the clues that stood out to me.
Four handmade picks made by spot welding pieces of steel approximately 24 inches long, a Kmart dry cell battery with short pieces of wire attached to the terminals, a green and white suit bag containing several partial sticks of dynamite and a trouble light, two green plastic Cobb Exchange bank bags, five cloth Cobb Exchange night deposit bags with locks, a man's white t-shirt, three sets of keys, two welding torch tips, one Premier electric fan, one electric on and off switch, an empty Winston cigarette pack, an Avon aftershave bottle, one green Regal coffee percolator, an Anison bottle, two empty Benson & Hedges cigarette packs, an empty cardboard bucket from Kentucky Fried Chicken, dozens of cotton gloves, one hacksaw and two hacksaw blades, one folding cot, a green cotton towel, one metal ice scoop, a long piece of garden hose with an approximately 4-inch metal cylinder attached to it with medical tape. The piece of metal appears to be a vacuum cleaner extension rod, a heavy-duty yellow extension cord with a black piece of wire attached to it and attached to the side of the side tunnel entrance to what is apparently a buzzer system, a half-pint bottle of A&A whiskey containing a small amount of liquid in the bottle, six electric blasting caps, 10 fuse-type blasting caps, 15 quarter sticks of dynamite.
Looking at the evidence and what officers discovered in the first few hours of the investigation, you can imagine a narrative unfolding. These clues tell a story.
I heard that you guys had found buckets of Kentucky Fried Chicken.
Well, that's there. They ate there. I mean, you know, they spent the night there. And, of course, they was in no hurry. I mean, they evidently took their time and know where it come up, you know, and how to get inside the bank. I didn't figure anybody would ever do that. I mean, that was our furthest thought, or was mine. You know, when the alarms was going off, I didn't think anybody had tunneled under Roswell Street as busy as it was, and I didn't even think about it. It didn't even come to my mind.
Three men digging night and day, hauling heavy clay out of an unstable tunnel and into the back rooms of the suite. At least two men on at a time, working in shifts, one in the tunnel, one in the side, using a buzzer to send messages back and forth. Taking breaks on the fold-out cot with a bottle of whiskey and arthritis reliever. Working into the early morning hours, fueled by coffee, cigarettes, and fried chicken from the KFC, less than a mile down Roswell Street. Gloves stained with red clay, nitroglycerin, and tobacco. The whining of power tools echoing off the empty office walls. Engulfed in darkness and thin air, wedged inside wet earth just large enough to crawl through, lit by a small torch of flashlight, digging toward their obsession for weeks on end. Aside from the physical evidence law enforcement discovered at the scene of the crime, police were quick to piece together physical descriptions of the three men in question thanks to eyewitness testimony from employees at the Cobb County Emergency Aid and landlord Arthur Crow. Florence Bedingfield, the owner of the Cobb County Emergency Aid, told Marietta police that about 2 months before the burglary, a man came to their office to introduce himself as Mr. Murphy, their new neighbor. Mr. Murphy, described as white in his mid-50s, close to 6 feet tall, weighing about 150 to 160 pounds, of slender build and short gray hair, wore glasses, smoked profusely, and always smelled of alcohol. He was often spotted wearing dress clothes with a tie, but Miss Bedingfield noted the clothes never really matched. The owner of the up-and-coming hair salon informed her he was working on some problems in the office he would be correcting over the coming weeks before opening. Shortly before their introduction, a handwritten sign appeared on the glass double doors of the basement office, which read, "Murphy Hair Styling" and "Coming Soon." Mr. Murphy was often seen with the two other men coming and going from the basement office at no certain hours. The second man, who we'll now call man number two, was described by Mrs. Bedingfield and her employee, Donna Lee, as an outdoor type, or possibly a construction worker. He was white, in his mid-30s, and slightly shorter than Mr. Murphy, weighing close to the same. His brown hair was usually covered by a hat or a medium-length black wig. He was often spotted in work clothes, and the women commented he had a nervous demeanor. The third man, who we'll refer to as man number three for now, was also white, in his mid-20s to early 30s, with full, bushy blonde hair and a slightly stocky build. The muscular man was about the same height as the second, but heavier. He was most often seen wearing dirty jeans. Mrs. Bedingfield and Miss Lee reported Mr. Murphy would often come to the emergency aid office to make phone calls, though none of these conversations were ever overheard. He was also seen with man number two on the west side of the building, when man number two was noted to have carefully placed the black wig on his head. Mr. Murphy frequently left the emergency aid office to walk in the direction of the bank near the west end where the teller windows were located. The women also claimed to have seen a vehicle owned by one of the men parked on the far south corner of their parking lot, a blue Impala, most likely a mid-60s model. Whenever they would check the basement offices, Miss Lee and Mrs. Bedingfield claimed they never saw anyone there, and the doors were always locked. Paula Cooper and Robert McKinney were also interviewed and stated they remembered a second vehicle associated with the men, a dirty white 1965 or 1966 Dodge van. Arthur Crowe reported to police that he had only ever met Mr. Murphy once, but he felt he could identify him again if needed. The lease revealed his full name to be Harold A. Murphy. Mr. Murphy paid Mr. Crowe 2 months' rent and a deposit, totaling $1,500, when he signed the lease on March 5, 1974. Law enforcement ran the name through the National Crime Information Center database, but came back empty-handed. By a stroke of luck, Mary DePolice were able to catch their first big break that day of the burglary. A neighbor near the emergency aid building on the corner of Park Street had reported the blue Impala as a suspicious vehicle on March 29, 1974, about 3 weeks before the burglary. From the report, police were able to identify the car as a blue 1967 Chevrolet Impala with a license plate number. The tag on the car had been purchased by one Robert Earl LaCroix of Marietta, and the car was registered to Leslie Robert Ray of Ackworth, a town just northwest of Marietta. Police now had three names to investigate. Before we close out this episode, I want to leave you with one of the most shocking pieces of information I discovered when reading through these police reports. To truly understand the gravity of this evidence, you have to know the local lore behind this story. Among most of the news archives I found and interviews I conducted with Marietta locals, this tale ends almost as suddenly as it began. You'll discover throughout our story in later episodes that most residents never knew who perpetrated the bank robbery as far as their recollection goes. There was no trial, no front page story, no mugshots. It started with a bang and fizzled. In the weeks after the robbery, rumors would fill the space where law enforcement remained tight-lipped about the investigation. The tunnel would be filled by the Georgia Department of Transportation to avoid a sinkhole in the busy road. Banking resumed at the Cobb Exchange. Police claimed the burglars were amateurs who made off with about as much money as they had paid for in rent. OMs would recall the tale fondly and smile, likening our story to an urban legend of petty thieves who had toiled away for months on end, only to come to the surface empty-handed, their spoils made rich as the Georgia red clay. nothing could be further from the truth. On day one of their investigation, Merida police had discovered that our devious trio had made off with at least $20,000 in cash and checks. Yep, you heard that right. Immediately following the discovery of the tunnel, Lou Abernathy checked the bank deposit logs and reported that $22,065.82 had been taken from the vault. That is the equivalent of roughly $145,000 in today's dollars. I know what you're thinking. But Madison, why didn't anybody know about that? Why did the police let everyone believe the thieves only made off with $1,000? And while we're at it, why did this story fizzle out in the local news? Don't worry, I will answer those questions and more. On the next episode of Robbery, Inc., we'll explore the weeks following the Merida robbery as law enforcement closes in on our unknown subject, following leads and clues left by a master thief.
Oh my goodness, it just absolutely scared me to death. I can't believe it.
Well, let's put it this way. When people say, is Arthur Crowe your father? I say it depends on who's asking.
Did you think that was curious that you never, that nobody in town really ever knew who did this crime?
Sure did. I wonder about that, but it just happened.
But police had a tunnel of evidence. They had eyewitnesses. And come to find out, they had names. Our unknown assailants weren't far, and they wouldn't stay on the run for long. Robbery, Inc. is a production of Georgia Public Broadcasting and the Marietta Daily Journal. Robbery, Inc. is written and hosted by Madison Elizabeth Hogan. I'm on Instagram at Madison Elizabeth Hogan. This podcast was produced and edited by GPB's podcast team of Jeremy Powell, Jake Cook, and Mark Davenport. Special thanks to Olivia Watkin, Jaden Henson, and Rachel Kellogg.